From WUOT News, this is The Method, a series exploring the intersection of science and society. I'm Brandon Hollingsworth. On this edition of The Method, we're looking at the ways science is involved in public policy. When Secretary of State John Kerry has questions about science, he turns to his science and technology advisor, Bill Colglazier. He recently sat down with WUOT's Chrissy Kuiper to explain the way he helps bridge the gap between science and political policy.
Every country I've dealt with, the first thing they want to talk about science is the role of science technology to innovation and economic development. Almost every country has realized now that in this hyper-connected, globalized world, that if they're going to have a prosperous future for their citizens, they're going to have to become more capable in science and technology, figure out how to connect that to make an innovative society, knowledge-based society, and use it to translate into good jobs and middle-class incomes and higher standard of living. So most of my time actually is engaging with, and our staff engaging with countries, talking about how do you create a more knowledge-based, innovation-based economy using science and technology as one of the tools.
What's the first step for a country like that?
It really starts with human resources first. So that's the educational system, everything from grade school to graduate school, creating great research universities like here at the University of Tennessee and national laboratories. That it's also government policies that can sort of help facilitate rather than retard creating an innovative ecosystem. So it deals with a wide variety of issues, investments and regulations, tax policy, immigration policy, how do governments incentivize entrepreneurs to want to create companies, make it worthwhile for investors to invest in new high-tech startups, how to connect their private sector to their research sector.
What about issues that have to do with climate change and economic development?
Yeah, the other major conversation about science technology that we have with countries are all the issues that face the world where science technology are a very important component of sort of bringing the right information that policymakers need. And certainly energy and climate change are at the top of the list, but it's also public health issue, dealing with natural disasters, dealing with security issues. So almost every issue that the State Department faces in terms of our relations with the countries, there's some component where science and technology is absolutely crucial. And the security issues also deals with things like arms control and non-proliferation, cybersecurity. Almost every issue you can think of that the government faces in our interaction around the world, there is some component where scientific and technological information is just absolutely essential.
Is science then, at least in your position, it sounds like it's about politics.
It is. It's not good to have science be a political football and viewed that way. That's because I think every administration recognizes that for America's future, that our capability in science technology are absolutely crucial and that can be used for diplomacy and in engaging with countries. So in some sense, we try to keep science out of politics, but we also try to use science as a way to advance America's goals and advance America's interests.
What are some of those goals?
I think in terms of trying to help other countries become more capable in science and technology, to become more innovative economies, you might think, well, that's just going to create more capable competitors. It's going to make our life difficult. I think the view is, though, that if we can help expand the middle class around the world, have more countries rely on scientific information and the way they make their policies, it will lead, hopefully, to more rational policies, more stable governments, more income in these countries, which is, one, good for America's exports, but it's also, I think, very good for trying to have more stable societies around the world that rely on scientific information for making policy. So we certainly try to push our interactions on those issues. We think it is in the U.S. interest to, I want the U.S. to remain number one in science technology, and I think the only way to do that is by finding who are the best people around the world and engaging with them, and so increasing scientific cooperation with very bright, creative scientists, engineers, and other countries is the only way we can maintain the U.S. at the forefront.
Bill Colglazier, the Science and Technology Advisor to the U.S. Secretary of State, speaking with WUOT's Chrissy Kuiper. Years ago, the Los Angeles Aqueduct opened, accomplishing two major achievements, supplying the water that allowed L.A. to grow into a thriving metropolis and setting off a century-long battle over water resources. While the fight over water in the American West has been in the news for decades, attention is now shifting here to the Southeast. Political cracks are developing as states and cities try to divvy up our limited water resources.
What we're seeing is the issues that we had out west have now moved east.
Terry Tyler has spent a lifetime in the energy industry, studying how we use natural resources. Today, he works with the Howard Baker Center for Public Policy in Knoxville, and he's working on policy solutions to the region's water problems.
You've seen Atlanta grow significantly. You've seen other major metropolitan areas grow significantly. You know, it's back to the old economic law, supply and demand. Anytime the supply gets shorter than the demand side for it, then you get into these issues about who owns what rights to what.
Earlier this decade, rainfall levels in the Southeast dropped severely, and the ensuing drought stoked heated debates over water rights in Alabama, Georgia, and Florida. The rain returned this year, but the battles over water remain. In May, the Georgia legislature approved a resolution that seeks to move its border with Tennessee north, just far enough to give it access to the Tennessee River near Chattanooga. Some cities can drill wells to tap underground water sources called aquifers, but that opens up new problems.
I'm not so sure the aquifer underground is the right way to go, because you've seen problems out west where stream flow dries up and you immediately try to find fresh water supplies underground. People pump the water out and all of a sudden you get subsidence. The soil sinks, which leads to cracked foundations and a whole host of other issues.
Tyler is also concerned about the state of water infrastructure, the network of pipes and valves that bring water from reservoirs and treatment plants into your home. Think leaky pipes or a bulky sink that won't stop dripping, but then multiply that to the scale of an entire city.
The typical numbers you hear quoted is for every 10 gallons of water that you put into a system at the water treatment plant, you only get 4 to 6 gallons of water delivered to end customers. So that's a 40% to 60% leakage rate in the infrastructure itself, which just tells you the physical shape of that infrastructure.
It's hard for cities with tight budgets to commit millions of dollars to fixing problems with their water systems. And that's to say nothing of the inconvenience of digging up streets and yards to get to water pipes that have been buried for decades. But Terry Tyler says the long-term benefits outweigh the short-term inconveniences. At the same time, cities throughout the South are getting bigger, not smaller, meaning lawmakers and the public will be caught in the growing pains for years to come. That's The Method from WUOT News. Listen to this installment or any of our previous editions online at WUOT.org. I'm Brandon Hollingsworth.